Today is October 29th, and we're doing number 9, Korach's Revolt. From Midbar Parish, Tessai. Okay, there's a thesis I'd like to share with you here that is... Korach in general, but there's some particular thesis I'd like to share with you first. It'll take about a half hour, and in order to put forth this thesis, I would like to predicate it with other examples in the Tanakh where what I'm trying to show takes place. I could use many examples. I have to use them in different shiurim. I'm going to choose one dealing with Mechirat Yosef. Perhaps one of the greatest examples of what the ancients called, what scholars call sapiential literature, where it's a whole story, and when you finish reading the whole story, you get to really see what the wisdom of a Homo sapien is. It's what's called sapiential literature, meaning the wisdom of what it means to have the struggles of mankind. Right? There's everything in this story. There's jealousy, this, you know what I'm saying? I don't have to go into all that, but you know the story. So here is the thesis, and again, this is going to relate to Korach and his revolt. That my thesis is that sometimes biblical, I will use narrative, sometimes possibly even law, although I'm going to stay away from law today on that topic, and but even prophecies. There are some prophecies that sometimes rely on the reader being very attentive, and that the reader will connect my prophecy to a famous story to let people know that I'm plugging into that story without actually saying so. In other words, let's say I have a prophet that says, you guys are behaving like Yosef's brothers. And you know how bad Yosef's brothers and how much trouble that caused. Right? And that kind of stuff doesn't happen in Tanakh. Right? I will tell you that you know the closest I can think of this is Yirmiyahu in chapter 9 when he refers quite prodigiously to the deceit of the Bnei Yisrael at the time. You're cheating, you're lying, everything is deceit. There are like 9 different words, synonyms for deceit in chapter 9 of Yirmiyahu. It's amazing. And then he says, don't trust even a brother, because everyone is so intent on surviving that your brother has to have his. He wants his children to survive. He'll even deceive you, right? So Yirmiyahu writes, "Ki kol och, every brother is a kov Yaakov." Right? You don't have to be too creative to see. He's plugging into, I mean, Yirmiyahu, how dare you use this kind of word for what point you're trying to make. Who's the first person to make this point out of this name? Esau, because after he learned that his brother came in before him, he said, Achikara Shmo Yaakov. Right? Why is his name Yaakov? Not because he was holding on to my heel when he was born, but Yaakveni Zep Amayim. And Yitzchok says, he did this to you before? When? He says, I'll tell you when. Es Bechorasi Lokach. And Yitzchok says, really? You sold him a birthright? When did you do that? And he goes, oh, a long time ago. He goes, so, you know, everyone asks, why did Yitzchak go along with this? This whole thing was subterfuge. The whole thing was like, you know what I'm saying? This was a false pretense. Why didn't Yitzchak just cancel that bracha and say, okay, listen, don't worry. Right? That question can be asked in many different directions. And even halachically, can you celebrate, right? So, I would tell you, the Bechor Shor has an amazing point on this. Bechor Shor says that what Yitzchak said at that point was, Esav, you should have told me this. He says, Gam Baruch Yehiye. Now I see why he had to get that bracha. You sold it. It's not yours. I'll give you a different bracha. Right? But that bracha that I meant for you is his. But Yitzchak has to be careful because, you know, Esav, he knows Esav's temper perhaps, and he knows, you know, that Esav has great cover for him. But Yitzchak, look, there's a lot of, let's say, strategic reaction going on. But we're pointing out to you is that, look, Yaakov Avinu is davening, mentioning his name every day in our opening line, davening. Yirmiyahu has him being, you know, there's no doubt he's plugging into a particular character when he's saying this. Yirmiyahu knows there's a guy named Yaakov who Yaakveni wants. Okay? You know what I'm saying? So, this is my again, I'm still in my pretense about this other prophecy. The prophet at hand is Amos. Okay? Amos and together with Hosea, are two of the most important prophets in our history. We don't appreciate it. I teach a course here called Amos and Hosea Together, or Hosea Amos. I'm not sure which one was first in the name of the course, although it would appear that Hosea, at least according to Chazal, precedes Amos. So, but he's first in Tresor, so we call it Hosea Amos. Fine. So, Hosea and Amos were the first two prophets. They're before Yeshayahu, and certainly before Micha. So before then, before these four prophets, the only time you see a prophet in Tanakh is to talk to the king or the leaders. Right? You don't see prophets getting up on a stump and announcing to the masses, God is not happy with your behavior. It's possible that Eliyahu did that kind of stuff, or Elisha did, but there's no book about that, right? You know what I'm saying? So Hosea and Amos come to the world, to the northern tribes, Yishael and Micha to the southern tribes, and they tell them, this cannot be sustained. Your behavior, in the face of, you know, what you can read and say from Malachim, about the way the kings behave, the way the people behave, is not going to last much longer. There are new nations on the block. Right, your traditional enemies, Aram, Moab, Ammon, you know, all those guys, the Plishtim, Edom, they're small fry and small potatoes. There's a new kid on the block named Ashur, and then that's Yishayahu and these guys, for Yirmiyahu, Bavel, and they're the putty in my hands, they're the rod of my wrath, to teach you that you can't continue this. The Jews started to behave you know, and imitate the nations to such an extent that God said it's going to be destroyed. And these prophets had the chutzpah to tell them that. Okay? So, I'm leaving aside Hosea now, because Hosea mostly speaks to the upper crust. He has an inner past to the, he talks to kings, he talks to leaders. Okay, there is one prophecy at the end of Amos to be sure that whether there's some interaction with the king through a high priest, but Amos is usually talking to the people. He's talking to the masses. Okay, and I submit to you that chapter 2 and 3 of Sefer Amos is meant to bring about a recollection of Mechirat Yosef. It's a tall order, right? You need your full Tanakh there for me to show it to you straight through, but. But it's a tall order, but if you know your Haftorahs, what's the Haftorah of Parshas Vayeshev, where Yosef is sold, is Amos chapter 2. And it's very famous that Rashi and other commentaries say the connection between this chapter and the Haftorah is only determined by Drash. And what do I mean? Listen to this pasuk, you may be probably familiar with it. It says, Al shmosha pishei Yisrael al arba'a lo ashimenu. I was willing to forgive you for three sins, but I'm not forgiving you for the fourth. Al michram ba kesef tzadik ve'evyon ba'avur na'alayim. Because you sold a tzadik into slavery for a pair of shoes. Hence the, have you heard that? I asked you before. What was Yosef sold for? Targum Yomis and in the issue said they sold for shoes. It doesn't say so. So they said it says it sold it for 20 shkolim. Doesn't say that what they did with that money, right? But in Amos, this tzaddik is sold for a pair of shoes. Even Rashi, forget about the pshat before Shem, like Radak and Ibn Ezra. Even Rashi says that pasuk in Amos is not talking about Yosef at all. It's talking about the despicable, disgusting habit in Israel at the time that if someone couldn't pay back a debt even on a pair of shoes, they would take your children. They would sell tzaddikim into slavery for debt. Not just debtors' prison, debtors' slavery. That's a rule in the Torah. There's, if you steal, you can't pay back. That's every ivri, but there's no debtors' slavery. But that's what they were doing. Right? And this pshat in Amos that Rashi gives, and all the portion of it, it's a simple pshat of what Amos is saying, is actually recorded in the beginning of Melachim Bet. Remember the woman comes to complain to Elisha that the creditor has taken her two sons, right, as slaves? She's a widow and she just has two sons and the creditor has taken them away. What a disgusting, despicable place. Now, do you see what Amos is doing? The pshat is clear. The pshat is that Amos is talking about a contemporary, here's, get this now, because this is the point I'm trying to make, is talking about a contemporary despicable issue that has become commonplace. And I have to debunk this. If you ask the person on the street, isn't that terrible? She lost her two children. Well, that's what you have to do if you don't pay your bills. Right? That's the way people would talk about this. Okay? There's a whole, Amos tried to insert a whole sea change into this. There's no safety net for widows who can't pay back debt. How can that be? Right, you see it? So Amos, what Amos is doing is that he wants to show an event in history that everybody can agree was egregious and caused us great consternation and great pain is Hagdol Ha'Eved. Okay. It's well known in Haftorah circles, people who teach Haftorahs, that the Haftorah Vayeshev is the most disjointed Haftorah of the entire year. What's in there about Parshas Vayeshev? Except Am Yichon Ba'Keset Tzadik Ve'Yon Ba'Von Alayim. And the answer is, if you look through the rest of the chapter, right, there is stuff about Yosef all over the place. Listen to what Amos. Now, if you were living in Amos' time, you could have a thousand things to say. But what he chooses upon is violation of Arayos, right? Sexual permissiveness. Okay. And he says, you know how bad it is? Men take their sons to Zonos in order to train them about this is sexuality. Father and a son go to the same Nahara. A disgusting, despicable thing. Right? But you know, in Parshas Vayeshev, there is a father and a son who are with the same woman. Yehuda. Right? In fact, two sons. Right? They're both married to Tamar. And he ends up either marrying her or certainly fathering two children with her. Right? thing. Okay, next. He refers to violent clothing. What would be violent clothing in a Torah society? Clothing being violence? So Amos explains. People are so corrupt. You lend out, you're anxious to lend out money because anytime you lend money, there's risk that you're not going to be paid back, right? Plus, debt is canceled sometimes in some years. So the Torah warns us, don't refrain from lending out money for this fear. But you are allowed to take collateral, right? Lend me $100 and hold on to my, well, I probably hope at least $100 watch unless I pay you back. So I really will pay you back, okay? And you have this till Tuesday. If I don't pay back by Tuesday, now, what the next line in that statement can be anything you agree on, okay? If I don't pay you back by Tuesday, you keep it, and I have 2 weeks to pay you back afterwards to get my watch back at no extra cost. Go to a pawn shop, you're going to have to pay a lot more. Right? Okay? So this is what Amos is saying. He explains himself. He says, you know what violent clothing is? If your clothing has blood all over it, because you take clothing as collateral, knowing that the person who borrowed from you, he doesn't say that you're charging interest. That would really be sick. But you're taking collateral, and any violation of the loan agreement, you're keeping it. Those clothes have blood. Connect that, please, to Parshas Vayeshev. Right. Brothers put blood all over Yosef's coats to show to their father. So, a violent garment with blood all over it because you're violating the Torah and how you take collateral. Right? Now, I can go on and give you 4 or 5 others, but I just wanted to get you in there, and then we'll do what I want to do with Korach. Is that we say that Amos is purposely using imagery from the story of Yosef to plug into what he thinks the people are doing wrong now. A story that's pretty famous in Israel, a story that pretty much everybody knows, and that everybody can agree with. You know, when you start your sermon, these guys are good because they got into Tanakh, you know. You start your sermon, you can say, would anybody here, if you raise your hand, if you think that there's any justification for the way the brothers treated Yosef? They all look around and say, It's, you know, it's sort of like the way that the prophet tells David about 2 men in his kingdom where one is rich and one is poor, and one, you know, I'm talking about with the sheep. You all know what I'm talking about, right? And then David pronounces a sentence and he goes, you are that man. Now think about that. Do I have to explain what, right? You all know what I'm talking about. The rich man takes the poor man's sheep, right? So this is how the prophets, the ingenuity of the prophets, of weaving in and out a particular prophecy. These good sermon givers do the same thing. Okay? Amos had the additional problem. This is not a commercial. I'm not teaching Moshe Amos next semester or anything. But it's an additional problem is that Amos didn't come from the north. Amos came from Tekoa, which is where Yehuda. As you see at the end, people say, get out of here. Who are you from down south telling us what we should do up here in the north? Go back to where you came from and give prophet and eat your bread there. And he goes, he answers, I'm not a prophet. I'm not the son of a prophet. I have a job. I don't give prophecies for profit. Excuse the pun. I'm not a prophet for profit like your guys who just kiss up to you and tell you what you want to hear. Right? So almost, you know, he made a living. In fact, in the book, it tells 2 different things he did for a living. One is that he was a nokeid, a nokdim, he was a shepherd, and he was boleis shikmin. He was a 10, He surveyed trees and tended to sycamores and them. Right? So why does it have to tell us what he did for a living? Do we care what Yechezkel did for a living? Right? The answer is for the true prophets, prophet was not their job. No one makes a living as a prophet. In fact, one of the greatest Rishonim, Ramban, was a physician. Rashi was a vintner. Right? These guys had their regular jobs. I mean, this is my focus, the Rambam and the Gaonim, whether, you know, in the time of the Tanoim, a lot of the Tanoim had jobs, you know, Yochanan HaSandor, right? And Hillel was a water carrier. And Yitzchok Nafcha, he was a smith. So the Rambam says, that's true always. Rabbis should have a way to earn a living beyond just sitting and learning Torah. Right? And you always had to do something else. The Gaonim disagreed. The Gaonim said that's what those guys did when they were in college, when they were 21, 24. Right? I was a maintenance mechanic in college. Right? And a job in a hospital. Mom just did. You know, the blue overalls and all along with it, you know, checking in the boiler room and everything. You know, it took a, you know. And you got a license to do that. And you took a course and you passed it. Anyway, so almost. This is what he does. The story of Yosef pervades his book and how this country is being torn apart as a result of you behaving like those guys. And let me tell you how to fix it. Okay? Right? So it's amazing. You should read every prophet like this. Right? Because every prophet has a mission and a derech. Not, you know, usually not one, just one derech. Almost it's just 9 chapters, and the chapters are pretty short. You could read through it in a half hour in English, and really get a good, I say in English because I know I'm in trouble with Hebrew here, but you can read through it quickly, right, with a smattering of Mefarshim, and get a good picture of what the whole book is about. And what he uses is Mechiras Yosef as his guide. Now, here in the Torah, Moshe has to present the story of Korach. So Hashem tells him, Hashem Omer Moshe Kosev. You know, how is this story going to be presented to the world in perpetuity? Okay. So the first thing we have to know is what is Korach's gripe? Alright? There are two leaders of Israel. There's Moshe and Aaron. Right? And we'll see, if we just read a few psukim, that the gripe could possibly be something against Moshe. It could also be something against Aaron. Okay? This course is called Moshe's leadership, right? But insofar as Aaron is either Moshe's right-hand man, or they work together, right? I asked this question at the beginning of the semester. Was Aaron always supposed to be Moshe's, like, front man? Or did Aaron only come because Moshe kept on complaining and saying, listen, I can't do this. I mean, that was Mamash at the beginning of the semester. We talked about the 5 stages of where Hashem has to convince Moshe again, 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 and again, and again to perform this mission. Right? You all remember? Okay, so, but there's one clear raya that Aaron was always meant to be part of the system because he's on his way already. All right, but now, if you still wanted to be a purist on this, I think Rashi is, that Aaron was only on his way because Hashem knew that Moshe would object and need Aaron. But it would have been better, Rashi seems to say that Moshe was supposed to be the Kohen, right? And Aaron was supposed to be the Levi. Right? The switch that you find in Parshas Shmi, right? Moshe is acting like the Kohen in the 7 days of Miluim. He's the one doing all the Kavanos. Aaron is the bottom. Aaron is behaving like Bnei Yisrael, getting the work of the Kohen. Moshe is a Kohen for just 1 week. Okay? So why does Rashi say this? Because one of the times when Moshe really just makes up excuses. God took care of all Moshe's excuses. I told you my name, I told you your mission, I told you that you don't have to worry about your speech impediment, I told you that the people will accept you, I gave you the miracles, and now you just say, Shlach no b'yatishlach? Now you just say, God, send someone else. Why didn't you tell me that first? That's like me telling you, listen, I need a minion tonight. Can you help me? I'm having a shlokish event for my father's yet, so I happen to be happy about it tonight. Then you say, oh, I'd love to come, but my car is a flat tire, so I can't make it. They say, oh, no problem. I have an extra car here. I'll give you the keys. And then you make up another excuse. That's proof that excuse was not a real excuse. Because I took care of it. Right? It's like in New York, I get so many stories. Someone comes to my office. It happens like every week or two. Someone comes into my office and says, I have a real problem. My car is stuck on Columbus and 103rd Street. I have four kids in the car. And they're all screaming. And someone came to look at the car and they said, I need to tow my car into Harlem to fix it. And it costs $47. Usually it's some kind of money, amount that's not too much, but also, money. And he says, Shalom, Shalom. He says a few Hebrew words. And can I just give him the money because the kids are getting crazy in the car and I have to take them home? So I tell him, you are in luck. My brother owns the garage on 96th Street. And he told me I can always, for a chesed like this, he has a tow truck, he'll tow your car right there and fix it on the spot. And if you want, you can even leave the four kids here. We have a playroom upstairs. You can leave them here while they stay with their car. All of a sudden, he doesn't really have the car. It's really someplace else. He already had it towed. He needed it. Hemming and hawing. I can see. I can look in their eyes. You can feel their pulse to see how much they're lying. Right? Excuse me. I don't mean to compare this to what Moshe's doing, but by saying Shlach no b'yatishlach, Hashem gets angry. This rush. Hashem gets angry. Moshe. No, at this point, Shlach no b'yatishlach is improper. You just made up four excuses. I responded to all four of them. Right? Now that I responded to all four of them and you're okay, now you still say send someone else? Okay, Moshe. Aharon, your brother, the Levi, is already on his way. He will help you with this. So Rashi says, why do you call him Aharon HaLevi? Right? What is he, the author of the Sefer HaChinuch? That's it. Aharon HaLevi, Barcelona, is like the unknown. I think that's why they called him that, because Aaron is called Aaron Alevi here. Aaron Alevi, so Rashi writes, Moshe, you were supposed to be everything. You were supposed to be the Kohen and everything. But now, with all your objections, okay, Kohen is going to your brother. That's Rashi. Okay? Well, you made no excuses. Okay, so... But would you agree that between what Moshe ended up being, which is no doubt a religious leader, right? And I'm going to call Aaron a spiritual leader. I think we might have discussed some of this early on when we talked about Aaron and Moshe as partners. The difference is that a spiritual leader is meant to elicit from the people feelings. That leadership is mostly ceremonial, would you agree? Right? It has outfits, it has uniforms, it has pomp, it has ceremony. Do you get it here? Do you agree? Right? It has ketores. You ever see what Mordechai, Aryeh Kaplan says about the ketores, whose main ingredient was... Bosem. Okay, you get a picture. Those guys were happy out there. Alright? So Aaron's job is to make sure the people love coming to the event. They love coming to the Beis Hamikdash. It's so exciting. Kids love it. That's your job. That's like a spiritual. Moshe's, and it's an aesthetic in nature. Salvation. There's great aesthetic quality to it. As opposed to Moshe, who's a religious leader, which tends to be drier. The religious leader is answering questions like, how big must my matzah be for my, to be Yotze? He's making measurements, he's filling out, he's doing, right? How much more do I have to eat? The religious leader wants you to keep the mitzvahs. Right? He should surely be concerned that the observance of the mitzvahs do change a person, but you have called this one a mathematical model. He's interested in aesthetics, he's interested in mathematics. Now, in other words, you know, just the events, just the listening to a shofar is a very, very aesthetic mitzvah on Rosh Hashanah. But it's not done if we're worried that someone's going to carry it in Rosh Hashanah. The Rebbe used that as an example to show that it's the religious leader that has to stay firm, and hopefully there will be a spiritual product, byproduct of your religious expression, right? This now is what the Rebbe of Soloveitchik explained, is what Korach wants. This is the first explanation. We're going to see all this in the Psofer. Okay. Is that Korach asks Moshe, what's the purpose of some of the mitzvahs? Right? He started to challenge Moshe's interpretation of the mitzvahs. Now, I'm going to put this here, but this mitzvah's here, but it's also here. Because, if this does not appear outright within the story, right? But it's the story right before it, the tzitzis. Korach looks at the tzitzis and Moshe, what on earth is this? What's the purpose of this blue fringe? And Moshe says, I asked God, and He told me that it's all about God's majesty. His color is majestic. Already in Shmos we heard that the throne of God looks like what precious stone? The Parshas Mishpatim. Sapphire. Okay? It looks like the blue of the Tcheles. And this world is a bit light for it. Somewhere between this and that. But you've seen it on census, I'm sure. It's maybe the blue of those flower pots down there is a little closer also. And the Tchelis reminds us of the crashing sea against the sky, and this is our the reason why it's in. And Korach says, you know, I like that. It makes sense. It touches me. But I'll tell you what I don't like. I don't like that it has to be a fringe wrapped around other strands. If the whole shirt is blue, which is certainly a much easier thing to do, why bother with the fringes? Well, forget about the fringes. What about a blue hanky in the pocket? What about a blue, you know, anything blue? A blue sapphire ring is even better. Or just a picture on the wall of the crashing sea against the horizon. Against the sky. Isn't that what the Gemara Menachos says that it's supposed to be? In other words, what does Korach want? He wants the independence. He doesn't want to be tacked down to what Moshe says the religious expression is. I want to get my spirituality on my own. I don't want to be burdened by the limitation of the religious part of the mitzvah. I love the mitzvahs. I want to get close to God too. We owe Him a great favor because He just took us out of Egypt. But Moshe, you've done nothing for us. This is now, why is Korach here? If Korach felt this way about Moshe, why did he wait till now to talk about this? Assuming, like Ramban says, that the Torah is in perfect order. What just happened? Bah, wrong. It's the perfect time for me to gain power. It's all about power. The question is how to get it. By showing that the men in charge are out of touch. There's no doubt that if you read the story of Korach, his revolt is against Aharon. What in Moshe? And that's what's coming out of his mouth. Right? He thinks that the test is a test of Kehuna. He's told, okay, you know what, Korach? You remember what happened to Nadav and Avihu, right? With Taurus? You want to try? You sure you want to do this? Right? It's not a setup. Moshe asks him, tomorrow we'll do this. Okay, it's a Kohen Gadol kind of thing. Of Soloveitchik's ingenuity is to create something within the, he's doing the Midrashim, of course, but to create something within the context of his rebellion that erodes the leadership of both Moshe and Aaron. Okay? To sweeten the pot, Rashi just says, you'll find a very nice medrash in the Tanchuma to really determine Korach's purpose. Rashi, why don't you tell us what that is? So we have to go look up the Tanchuma and see what it is. It's very clear. Okay, I'm going to write it on the board for you. Tanchuma says his revolt was this, that Levi had three sons, Gershom, Kehos, and Amram. Kehos and Merari. Okay. Kehos had four sons, Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, and Uziel. Nothing is known about Chevron. It's not mentioned again. We don't know his children. We don't know anything about him. Amram, we know plenty. He's got Moshe and Aaron. And Yitzhar has got Korach. And Uziel has a son named Eliezerpon. Does he ring a bell to you? In Bamidbar, there is a Rosh for each of these tribes. A person is named to be the president of the tribe. Great kavod. Right? The president of Kehos was this guy, Eliezerpon ben Uziel. That is what Rashi says. If you really get that, you'll understand what Korach's all about. It's raw power. He wants to get to the top, and he says, and I was passed over. I'm the second one. All right, Amram gets these two guys. But Yitzhar should get this, not number four. Now, Chevron is passed over. We don't know anything about him. But why did you pass over Yitzhar? Which tribe should naturally tack on to this? Now the class is over, and I didn't even get to why I brought to you almost. But it leaves me a good segue for an assignment I'm going to give you for Tuesday. Which tribe should naturally gravitate to this list of time? Reuven. We know that's in the story. But Reuven. Because Reuven has also been passed up, for goodness sakes. Right? What's that about? Right? Reuven has a natural ally in. Here's a picture's not even close to the home plate. Here, home plate is done. Here is Reuven. Second base is Yehuda. Third base is Ephraim. Each of these four tribes have two other tribes that are traveling with them, right? Three on each corner. In the middle is Aaron, with the three sons of Levi here, here, and here. Right? Kehos is here. Do you see? You ever hear of the famous Maimar Chazal? I always thought it was a pasuk. It's not a pasuk. It's Maimar Chazal. It's more at the end of Sukkah. What does it mean? Why did Reuven join Korach? Because
bad neighbors.
Oy l'rasha, oy l'shchina. Bad neighbors. Oy l'rasha, oy l'shchina. Woe to our wicked man. Woe to his neighbors. Right? So Korach is near Reuven. So Reuven comes along. Here, they're listening to his speeches in the desert, week after week. And now that he tells us that he's not even taking us into that land, get it! Now's my chance! Alright? Here is, in the final 2 minutes, my presentation. There was a story very early on in the Torah. It's a short story. It's a chapter, two-thirds of a chapter in the beginning of Bereishis. It's also the story of jealousy. Someone who thinks there's an arbitrary rule of merit and benefits. Right? Gives the Kohanim the right for all these things. Right? Korach has fears that, well, what do we live a bee and left with the crumbs? Moshe says, no, no, you're mistaken. You get, in some sense, it's a lot more than the Kohen. The Kohen just gets a small amount of truma. You're getting 10% from everybody. You're getting Meister Rishon, much more than the Kohen gets for his truma. Right? So Moshe tries to tell this mini as a grievance. His grievance, first and foremost, is with Kehuna. How Moshe fits in there, we'll get a little more, perhaps, but we'll just mention to you the spiritual aspect, the religious aspect. Korach's revolt is spiritual in nature. He wouldn't want to call a rabbi a religious leader. He wants the spiritual leader. He wants what the mitzvah makes you feel. I like that thing about the blue, but I don't want to be constricted to the religious constrictions of that it has to be with a blue fringe. I want that mitzvah on my own terms. If you read up on the early reformist writings in the 1840s in Germany and in America, this is exactly the reform movement. They were in favor of God. They were in favor of they moved away from Torah, but they were in favor of religious or spiritual expression. They just wanted the autonomy to decide to do it on their own. Right? Religious expression through humanism, let's say. But for the, right? Okay, they still had people going to shul. So Moshe comes down hard on Korach. The story is Cain and Hevel. Cain and Hevel. This is what I'd like you to do. I'm going to read Bereishis Perek Daled. This is what we're going to do on Thursday. In the Reparations Paradigm. And you're going to look for phrases, terminologies. I'll get you started. Hashem tells Cain, cursed is the ground that opened up its mouth to swallow the blood of your brother. In Korah's story, the earth opens up its mouth also. It's a very unusual terminology that does not appear anywhere else in Bereishis. Right? There is an earthquake in Amos. But you get the point. So look for those terminologies, and then you may also draw the conclusion that the story of Korach is told in a way that, just like Amos did with Mechiras Yosef, let's wrap up the whole class. That the story of Korach is told in a way which reminds the reader of Cain. But there has to be a takeaway for this one. What's the point? Why is it doing this? That should be obvious. But look for those connections. Try to find at least five. Okay, some will be linguistics, some will be terminologies, right? Obviously, you have to read both stories. You're not going to make them up in your head. Okay? So you have to have two chumashim open in front of you, probably, Tanakh, and then, Okay? All right, guys. Have a great day, everybody.